and welcome to Sustain, the podcast where we talk about sustaining open source for the long haul. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? How are we going to get out of this craw business? Yes, very excited today to talk about the CRA, the Cyber Resiliency Act, among other things. Very excited to introduce our guest as well. Before we do, I want to make sure you know who the voices are on this podcast. I am, of course, your host, Richard Litauer. Hello, everyone. And I'm joined today by my illustrious co-host, Leslie Hawthorne. Leslie, how are you?
Doing very well, Richard. Thank you. How are you doing?
I am tired. New Zealand is far away, but I am well. Thank you so much for joining us today as we greet Karen O'Riordan. I think I already messed it up. I tried very hard and I'm so sorry. Karen is joining us today from Brussels, where he is a senior policy advisor at OFE, that's Open Forum Europe, which is a really interesting institution that basically helps to figure out what's going on with open source in the EU all the time. It's kind of like a think tank, kind of like a policy set. We've had some people from OFE on this podcast before. I believe we've had Aster, who, if I can remember correctly, is the CEO, although I'm not sure he uses that term. Maybe he's just the director. But Karen, can you tell us today about what it's like being a senior policy advisor there, how you got that role, and what do you do?
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's a really interesting job, but I will sell the job maybe a bit later because I think a lot more people should be interested in working in policy. I really love it. My own background is that I was a software developer in Dublin. And when the Software Patents Directive was proposed, I decided that it was important enough that it would be a better use of my time. And so I came to Brussels to work on that particular file, and just found that there was another one after that and another one after that. And so I've now been here 20 years. So I worked for a few organizations, and then September 2022, I joined OFE. And this is now where I use all that experience from, mostly from the free and open source software domain, but also some automotive and corporate finance, GDPR, and a few other fields. Really glad to be able to drag all these together again and then refocus back on FOSS policy in the EU. And so what we try and do in Open Forum Europe, we try to look for the files that are not getting the amount of work that they require. And so there's a lot of industry associations, and they will have very specific things that interest them. And so in OFE, we try and look at the FOSS ecosystem in general and identify things that are going to cause problems on a structural level. And we try and work on those things. Or if possible, we try and help other people work on those things. Because if we can enable others to do this, then we can have much greater impact than if we just have a single person using their limited time per day working on these things themselves. So that's how we operate in general. With Cyber Resilience Act, we gave some input, and this is before I joined, so we, as in OFE, gave some input in May of 2022. And this was back when the European Commission had its initial call for input, and almost nobody responded to the call of input, but OFE put in a document. And so in a way, you could say that we were involved right from the start, but at the same time, the call for input back then, it was a very basic document. And so we didn't at that stage know exactly how big this was going to be. So the call for input was the Commission saying, we're going to do something about cybersecurity. And us responding was saying, well, be careful. And you know, so this is how it started back then. Then the actual text got published in September 2022. We looked at it and it just looked like it'd be impossible to implement this. And so we weren't sure if we were interpreting it correctly. And the more we read it and the more we started getting worried, we initially thought this is going to be pretty easy to work on because like everyone is going to see the problems that this causes free and open source software. And we're going to have a big coalition of all our usual allies of consumers and SMEs and digital rights groups. And everyone will be against this proposal. And we thought it would be pretty easy to get it fixed. We were surprised then to find out that a lot of other sectors were in favor of the Cyber Resilience Act, because when we looked at it, we thought about how it affects our development models. But from other people's point of view, they looked at the objectives and they saw, well, this increases cybersecurity. Why not? You know, we'd love to have better cybersecurity, especially if it just falls from the sky. And so we had the situation where we were the ones in the free and open source software ecosystem, the companies, the developers, the projects, who were going to have to actually implement all these obligations. And our software benefits all these other industries and other sectors, but we were the only ones who were pointing out that harming FOSS harms all these other interests and sectors. So our job wasn't to have one person working on the CRA in the hope that the one person could tackle something of this magnitude, but rather to get others involved, and that means making people aware that this needs to be worked on, helping people with the procedures and connecting people so they're all more efficient and doing things that are actually going to have an impact. That's kind of our role. We try and facilitate and improve the quality of policy work with a focus on the EU level for FOSS in general. Sometimes a bit broader, sometimes it'll go to other open technologies. A lot of the time, and right now, it's focused on software.
Thank you so much, Kieran. I have a two-part question. Part one is for folks who have been hiding under a rock and have never heard of the Cyber Resilience Act. Can we get the quick 2-3 sentence summary? And if you wouldn't mind adding on to that summary, some details on why it's particularly impactful to those of us working in the free and open source software ecosystem.
So the quick summary, it depends a little whether you look at the proposal that was published in September 2022. And that's still interesting because that's the reason why we had to scramble and organize and do all the work we did for the last year and a half. Or if you look at then the final version. So the proposal from 2022, it was quite interesting because it contained a sentence which more or less said, you can only publish software if, and then gives you a long list of requirements. And so this was replacing the general freedom to publish. And so until then, software had mostly been considered to be the same as literature. And in this sense, there was a general freedom to publish software. And so the CRA was then changing this and saying that you can publish software if, and then gives you a list of criteria. And so the list of criteria, sometimes it's procedural, sometimes it's, you know, you have to keep records of who's using the software. Sometimes it's technically very difficult. For example, you have to have default configuration, which is secure, which can be very difficult if you don't know what the user is going to do with the piece of software. Or it might say that the software can't be published if it has any known exploitable security vulnerabilities, which is complicated because there are a lot of known exploitable security vulnerabilities that exist. And if that was applied strictly, it would mean that a lot of software packages have to simply no longer be distributed in Europe. So it created all these procedural issues. Layer one is like the direct compliance with the directive, or sorry, with the text. And then layer two would be, how do we get our development models and our business models to continue to work with this? And how do we tell people outside of Europe that if they want their software to be distributed in Europe, it would be really helpful if they provided this information about the development process? And sometimes the answer will be, we don't really care if our software is distributed in Europe. That's your problem in Europe, whether or not you can distribute our software. Already doing an act of charity by putting our software on the internet for everyone to use. And so this is compatibility issue for our development model. And then we have to think about the social dynamics of how can we encourage people to help out with the compliance procedures. So this is what we were worried about starting in September 2022. And during the procedure, we managed to get a lot of different changes. And the text changed quite fundamentally right up until the last few months even. The final version, what we have now, it's a lot better. It has certain clauses that give a lighter regime if you're distributing software as free and open source software. And in a lot of situations, we won't have any obligations, or the obligations that we have aren't backed by fines. And so there would be, it'd be quite easy to comply, and there's not much of a risk if you're out of compliance. However, at the same time, the obligations do apply to commercial distribution. And our ecosystem is strong because we have companies that are part of the ecosystem. And so we still have the challenge of how do we ensure that the companies of our ecosystem can continue to distribute and provide services and employ programmers and all the other people that we need for our ecosystem. How can we ensure that they are still able to do all the compliance necessary for the CRA? So in that sense, the final version is a lot softer. There are a lot of people will not have obligations. So I think you're not aware that you're commercially distributing the software, you probably don't have obligations. And so in that sense, it's a lot softer. But at the same time, it is going to be complicated for us to figure out how we can ensure that companies remain effective and remain able to hire the same number of people and how they remain in Europe as well. That's an important one for the people in Europe and for the governments as well, because if they want to increase cybersecurity, then having the development take place in Europe makes sense. So there are people in Europe who can respond to cybersecurity incidents. So that's the difference between the two. The original version had a lot of obligations and it was not clear who they applied to. The final version, there's a lot of clarifications about who will not have obligations or will not risk fines, but there will still be a lot of market regulation and compliance to be done, particularly by companies.
So without diving too deep into the great intricacies of the text, I'm wondering if you can shed some light on one question that I've seen frequently, which is how are software foundations who are responsible for overseeing and bringing together developers to produce software that is then later commercialized, impacted by the Cyber Resilience Act?
So the final version contains this new category called open source stewards. And this creates a new category of software entities. I have to be careful each time about the words because the text uses words in the way that we don't use words. So the text talks about putting products on the market, and we talk about distributing software. And so the text has a different clause about being a distributor. And so I'm using our own terminology rather than terminology from the CRA. But in the final text, if you are a foundation that is distributing code, then you are probably an open source software steward, and in which case you have a reduced set of obligations and there are no fines attached to the obligations. So in many ways, in theory at least, there won't be obligations or there'll be very light obligations on the foundations. However, what might happen is that the foundations might realize they want companies to be distributing and commercializing and providing services for the code that they are helping to shepherd. And so we might find that foundations, although they're not obliged to do these things, they either do it because they think it's useful service, or they might even feel that they are obliged by the market rather than by the actual legislation. So it still remains to be seen exactly how it will be dealt with. Hopefully the foundations will have the time and will be able to organize their compliance such that a lot of it will be automated. We're hoping that a lot of the automation could even be built into the code hosting platforms, and then adding on a few thin layers involving checklists and some data gathering, then hopefully this can be done in a way that's not too difficult for the foundations and will make it easier for companies to stay and to join our ecosystem. But I should actually mention just the timeline, because the text got agreed recently. However, it hasn't been officially signed by the European Union institutions. That this will probably happen sometime around May, maybe even in the summertime. Once that signing happens, then the CRA will take effect. It'll come into force 3 years after that. So we're talking summertime 2027 is when the CRA will actually come into force and compliance will become obligatory for the people who will have the obligations. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that in between now and 2027, there will be a series of standards written. There are approximately 44 obligations in the Cyber Resilience Act. And for each of those, the European Commission will send a standards request, and European standards body will have to develop a standard for how to comply with that obligation. And so the first obligation is the obligation to not distribute if there are known exploitable security vulnerabilities. And that is going to be the subject of one standard. And so the standard will be a little bit more of a practical implementation of that single sentence obligation. So what will happen is the difficult way to comply with the CRA will be to take the text yourself and think of your own procedure for how to comply with that text. The standard should be an easier document to work with. It should be more practical, more detailed. And if you follow the standard, then you get a legal presumption of being in compliance with the CRA. So we are going to have quite a lot of work in the next 2 to 3 years to be involved in these 44 standards writing procedures to ensure that these standards can be used by free software, which means there's no patent problems, that we actually have access to a copy of the standard, which would be nice, that there are no proprietary technologies that are required for implementing the standard, and that there are no incompatibilities with our general software development procedures and project governance. So we're going to have to work on that for the next 2 years, 2.5. And then after those standards are finished, that's when we'll really know what compliance is going to look like. So to come back to the question, the foundations are already working on thinking about how they can perform compliance. But at the same time, the real compliance procedure will only be written at the end of 2026 when we have all the procedures that are in the standards and then we know exactly what we're working with.
So I'm not European. This is probably pretty clear from my accent. And I'm interested in how this would affect me as an American. I have repos on GitHub. I have repos on GitLab. I probably have some somewhere in a folder or on a server. Do I have to worry about going through and checking all those because I'm a single person LLC as well? Because I'm technically a company and someone from Europe may eventually give me $5?
That is the type of question that we're going to have an answer to in 2.5 years' time.
Got it. It's hard to contextualize the CRA from an international perspective. I know the EU is really good at some things. GDPR is excellent. It's nice that it's everywhere. I get really annoyed at having to say no to cookies all the time. But when it comes to publishing things, I've always just assumed I can slap an MIT license on it and then have it go. When you talk about not publishing any code that has security risks, does that include something like an example repo of what a security risk would look like? Those are questions I would have, which I guess will be figured out through the obligations or through the standardization process.
I hope so. The obligation to not publish software with known exploitable security vulnerabilities, it's in a list that starts off with a paragraph about performing a risk assessment. And so having to apply that obligation strictly is subordinate to your risk assessment. And so in speaking with some of the people in the EU institutions, they were suggesting that this wouldn't be a problem because this type of scenario that you describe, you could perform your risk assessment and you could decide, well, this isn't code that somebody's actually going to use and therefore this isn't a risk. However, for me, that is not the amount of clarity I would like to have. And so that's the sort of thing that we hope the standards will really make simpler.
I hope so as well. Jules, those are some of my main questions as a foreigner, just trying to figure out how is this going to affect me? What am I going to need to do? I have another question, which is kind of a follow-on from what you've been saying earlier about the foundations all working together. When we talk about foundations, you're talking about the big players, LF, Eclipse, because there are a lot of small foundations that aren't properly staffed to deal with EU legislation. A lot of foundations are already really, really bootstrapped. And so I'm just really curious, what kind of foundations are you talking about?
Just to clarify, whether the foundations work together or not is probably less important of a question. I think the important thing is that the foundations are there and at least they can provide a certain level of services or procedures for the projects that are within their umbrella. And so the smaller foundations, maybe they'll band together with some of the larger foundations, or maybe they'll adopt the procedures from the larger foundations. I think that there will be separate groups with separate procedures for compliance, just because different types of software have different distribution models, different package formats with different levels of information in the package. And so I think it might just be more complex to try and develop a unified system for all of the foundations. So it might happen that LF might have their procedure that they ask all their projects to use, and Apache might have theirs, Python might have theirs, and Eclipse might have theirs. It might end up that we have half a dozen different procedures, and they'll learn from each other, and they could merge over time. It's very speculative at this stage. But as long as I think the foundations will have a great role in at least providing uniformity within their part of the ecosystem.
Banding together sounds like a lot of work, and having work come from the large corporations in general sounds like work. And then every single developer trying to figure this out sounds like a lot. One question which I don't have an answer to in my head, and maybe this is me being incredibly naive with how politics actually works. Who benefits from this act? Is there any reason to actually make it?
So this is an interesting one because the document was justified on the basis of cost. The document said that cybersecurity has a cost of X, and we think that compliance will have a cost of Y, and this means that overall this will actually make business more efficient in Europe. I think it's a difficult thing to prove or disprove because we don't have a number for what is the value of FOSS. And so we had our own number for a long time, which was 65 to 95 billion.
I was about to say, if we don't have a number, I've been using your number everywhere. So we have at least one number.
The new number from a study published by Frank Nagel is 8.8 trillion US dollars. And that is for the applications and server software, excluding operating systems. And so that's a new way of calculating this. And so when you have two numbers that are so different, then I guess it's difficult to...
His number is actually really interesting because his number came from the idea that every single company has to rebuild everything in-house. It doesn't take into account the possibility that someone may come up and sell software that then people would buy. So that shrinks the gap a lot. So they're different, but they're not as different as they might look at the beginning. Because I think your number was more about the replacement value for the ecosystem as a whole. Does that make sense?
It does. But I asked about that because I also thought, well, these companies aren't going to all write their own web server. And I got an answer. I'm sure there are people who have a good analysis of these studies, but I haven't time to do that yet.
Kieran, to head back to one of our earlier topics really quickly, when we talk about the process of creating standards so that we understand what compliance looks like for the CRA, one of the concerns that came up in the process of actually responding to the request for comment on the proposed legislation was that it was difficult for folks within the FOSS ecosystem to be able to respond because we did not have a huge lobbying arm to rock up and state our concerns. So how do folks in the FOSS ecosystem get involved to help influence these standards? Do they partner with a software foundation? Do they write a representative? Like, what is the best way to help influence these outcomes for the benefit of FOSS if you're a common, average, ordinary FOSS developer who is also really cool and a superhero because you're a FOSS developer?
So this is a question that I get a lot, and it's a really difficult one to answer. And I think the reason is because working on standards and policy in general, I've decided that it's about as complex as working on software development. And it's a bit like if I see that GNU Emacs version 30 is going to be released in a week, and I discover some part of it is too slow, and I go to the developers and I say, hey, I've got two spare days, tell me what you want me to do in order to make the software faster. It's not going to be able to just start doing somebody else's job on no notice. And this is what we have to, in our ecosystem, we have to think about how do we train and grow our policy ecosystem so that it is in a good position, so that we have the expertise, the volume of people, the connections, and then also the education, because we get something like the CRA, which means we haven't done enough work on explaining the value of free and open source software, and then also how it works. And that means the development models, the project governance, our internal legal frameworks, the business models. We haven't explained that well enough. If we had explained that well enough, then maybe we wouldn't have gotten CRA. And so this is something that we always have to work on for the future. And it's ongoing work. It's something that we can't wait until a certain piece of legislation comes along and the vote is in 2 weeks' time, and then we start panicking and saying, what can I throw resources at? It's just something, it's part of our ecosystem and it has to be worked on an ongoing basis. And so in terms of getting involved, I think the two important things are, first is to communicate with other people. And this is because the people that I've seen who were not working on policy 2 years ago and now are working on policy, I think they've all been able to make that jump by being in contact with a lot of people who are working in policy. And that's where you get to ask all your questions and you get to hear all the questions other people are asking, and you receive all the information and you receive the documents. And so I think being connected and being part of groups is essential to becoming effective when doing policy work. And then the second thing is the need to do some work on your own initiative without having already been brought into some of these groups. And so it's a little bit difficult for us sometimes because our software projects are usually built by trying to get the maximum number of people contributing to our software projects. So it's very transparent, it's very welcoming. But in policy, we have to do some of the work in private, and that's because either we're dealing with leaked documents or we're dealing with the contact information of people in the institutions. So there has to be a filter in some ways between people who initially want to get involved and then actually being part of the group that's working on these things. And so for people who want to make that jump from working on software and having an interest in policy to get involved in policy, I think talking to as many people and joining as many groups as possible is useful. And then just putting work in and doing, you know, something useful, something impressive is also how you convince people you should also be brought into the group. Because in policy, we try and grow them because we need more people. But at the same time, the larger you make the group, less people are comfortable in talking. And so we have to keep things a little bit small as well to maintain the trust levels. So we want to add people to the group as much as possible, but then recommend that people also do some of the work on their own initiative as a way to the secret handshake to get into the group.
Thank you so much for that. Could you talk a little bit about the OFE resource, the open source policy community list? Because I think that is a wonderful way for folks who would like to get engaged, to get connected to other folks in the policy space, like you've been talking about.
Yes. So we have, it's a multi-layered structure within OFE, and there are some task forces working on very specific topics. And then there's the CRA group, which grew to be quite a large group. And then we have the FOSS community list, which is a much larger group. It's a good way for us to be able to keep people informed and for people to be able to share news and ask questions to others. At the same time, it's quite a large group. It's 300 plus members at the moment. And there are people, you know, from a lot of different parts of the ecosystem and even from outside the ecosystem. And so it's not somewhere where we can do all our discussions. That is the main way that we try and get at least a first connection with people. And then even in the long term, it's a way that we keep people informed at a base level, at least. And so, yeah, we try and keep it fairly low volume. It's a good way if people want to make a first step or if they want to stay informed, then that's a good place.
I was just checking the stats and looks like the average open source project these days is over 500 dependencies. We didn't talk about dependencies at all in this podcast. I know it's a technical thing, but should I, as an individual, contact every single person whose dependencies I'm using and ask them to all band together to join the CRA mailing list? Is that the best way to take action? What am I supposed to do next?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that people have to remember this isn't coming into force until summer 2027. So for the moment, you know, there's no reason to panic this year or next year even. So there are still some questions that are unanswered, or at least I haven't heard the answer yet for how granular will compliance have to be. If I merge together a large number of software packages, do I do compliance for the entire unit? And then if somebody receives this unit or removes one software package, they have to do compliance for the 599 remaining. There are some questions that are still there. Some of them will be solved by the standards. Some of them will become very simple because somebody noticed the procedure can be automated. And so then the question will be not so important. But these are the sort of questions that a lot of people are going to be working on in the next 3 years. And I think we'll be okay for those kind of details.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about the Cyber Resilience Act. And I think that there's other legislation that is potentially equally interesting to folks in the FOSS world. Can you tell us just quick snippet on what is the Product Liability Directive and why, as a FOSS developer or participant in the FOSS ecosystem, we should care?
Yeah, so the FOSS ecosystem spent a lot of time and a lot of resources working on the Cyber Resilience Act. And the whole time, the Product Liability Directive was happening in parallel. And I think a lot of us just didn't want to look at it because we knew it was going to be as bad as we thought it was. And every time you do open it up a little bit, you just lift the corner, you shudder, and then you go back to working on the safety of working on the Cyber Resilience Act. So the Product Liability Directive is difficult because it creates liability for damage caused by software, and it doesn't require that there was any malice or even negligence on behalf of the software developer. So we did get some clarifications into the final version of the PLD, and it's not as bad as it was originally. It doesn't apply generally. There are specific clauses about free and open source software. So I won't go into the details of when it applies or how it applies, but it has been greatly improved alongside the CRA. And there was, you know, a lot of mixing as well, even inside the Parliament and in the Commission. We noticed that even though we put so much work into the Cyber Resilience Act, sometimes the piece of text that we got into the Cyber Resilience Act would then all of a sudden pop up in the Product Liability Directive. So you know, even without working on it directly, in a regular sense at least, we managed to have that improved. So one piece of legislation that is also interesting, at the same time, AI Act also has clarifications about free and open source software. And there was the Interoperable Europe Act, which contains soft obligations for governments to consider sharing your software. It's not, they're not quite making an obligation to share the software, but that's the Interoperable Europe Act. And then there are even some positive pieces of legislation. There's regulation on standard essential patents, which would actually be quite nice if it got adopted. And so here we have a bunch of ideas for how to improve it, but the time is running out. And so now we'd like to see is that this text gets adopted as quickly as possible. And we're happy to let all our good suggestions fall just so that this gets adopted. The standard essential patent regulation, its main clauses don't benefit us because the main clauses are about how do you create FRAND licensing for patents that are essential when implementing a standard. However, there's only one type of FRAND that can be implemented in free and open source software, and that's FRAND zero or FRAND with no royalties. And the procedure in the standard essential patents regulation is all about how will we divide up the royalties at the end. So the type of FRAND they're talking about will never be useful for us. However, a secondary part of the legislation is that there should be a register for all the patents that apply to a particular standard. And so this would be really good for us for a few reasons. One is that there would just be generally less FUD spread around, because instead of patent holders saying, we have some patents on that, they would actually have to put the numbers on a screen and say, we have that, that, and that. Secondly, if we thought a lot of these patents, and if the number of patents on a standard wasn't very high, then we could encourage people to check the validity of these patents, and we might find that can free up the standard. And then thirdly, if we had a list of all the patents that cause problems for a standard, that could also be used as a recipe for how to write version 2.0 of the standard without having those patent problems. Now, once you avoid these patents, you might end up having problems with different patents, so it's not a guaranteed solution, but it could be something that helps us eventually get to the utopia of patent-free data format standards. So there's the standard essential patents regulation. There are a few other pieces of legislation, but right now, because the elections are happening in summertime, the legislation is slowing down as all the people in the parliament are now focusing on their re-election campaigns. And so this is a little bit of a quiet period for legislation, which means we have to use this time now to prepare for the next 5-year legislature. So we've got a few months now to prepare. Then we'll have a new parliament, which will take their seats in July, although it really starts in September. So at that stage, we'll have to spend a few months trying to make first contact and trying to identify who the key people are going to be in the parliament. Then there should be a new European Commission in probably November. And at that point, we'll have to start working with them to talk about why their priorities should include supporting free and open source software. So that's more or less the little overview of the legislation for this year.
I like that you use the word first contact. To me, that implies reaching out to alien life, which is how I feel around working with policymakers. So I'm glad there's someone like you out there doing the good work for all of us. So please keep it up. Karen, where can we learn more about you and about OFE?
The best way to learn about OFE is to work with us. We don't do a very loud type of lobbying, and so our website is not full of pages and calls to action and that sort of thing that people might expect from campaigning organizations. We have a different strategy, and we've found that it's a good way to build up connections to people. And so, yeah, if people want to work with us, then joining the community list, which I think is on the website on the open source page. So at the bottom, there's the link for how to join the open source community list. Then if people meet us at conferences, we just spent 5 days meeting people at FOSDEM weekend, which now has expanded to a 5-day set of conferences. And yeah, we on our website, we also have other events that we will be physically present at. But yeah, trying to work together on something is always the best way to build a relationship that's going to last.
And you can find Kieran's social media on the show notes, which is at podcast.sustainoss.org, which reminds me that we are running up on time. Kieran, thank you so much for pointing to the Open Forum Europe website where you can join those mailing lists. I highly suggest other people do join them. They are fantastic. They're really, really good. I've been getting them for years. Just now I checked and Kieran had sent an email on one of them that had a Simpsons comic. So it's okay. They're engageable. It's nice. It's not so bad. Kieran, thank you so much for coming on. It means a whole ton to have someone with your experience and with OFE's clout to come and talk about what is going on with the CRA. It's still scary for me, but I think that's all right. We'll figure it out in the end. For now, we are running up on time. Before the end of the show, though, we always have our spotlight. Spotlight is where we highlight people, projects, open source projects, books, dog toys, whatever has really been useful for you in your life that you want to point out and say thank you to. Leslie, traditionally, you go first. What is your spotlight today?
I'm going to give a shout out to the open source and the European legislative landscape dev room that recently took place at FOSDEM this year, where you will be able to learn about many of the different legislative acts that Kieran has treated us to today in great detail from the panelists. All the videos are up on the FOSDEM site and link will be in the show notes.
Thank you so much. I'm going to highlight Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World. This is Chris Cooper's book about his experience of being a Black gay birder. I did not know a lot about his life, and I was very excited to read this book. I saw him once birding in Central Park, as did another woman once who was going to call the cops on him and say, "I'm being attacked by a Black man," which, as you may remember, happened the same day as other major protests in the U.S. and led to an international scandal, and now the word Karen is no longer a nice name. Highly suggest this book. It's really interesting to learn about his perspective on birding. I just thoroughly enjoyed reading it. So Better Living Through Birding by Christian Cooper. Karen, what's your spotlight today?
Yeah, I'd like to echo Leslie's spotlight on FOSDEM. I've been a fan of FOSDEM since before I moved to Belgium even. I went to FOSDEM for the first time in 2002, and that was one of the first things that brought me to Brussels. So that was where I got my inspiration to start working on policy topics. But at the start, you mentioned books that people are reading. So the two books that I'm reading at the moment, one is an Irish author, Liam O'Flaherty. And so I'm reading his first novel, Thy Neighbor's Wife. And the second book that I'm reading is by a Chinese author, Qi Li, and that is The Life Show. And so those are just two works of fiction that I find interesting just to help you understand other people's points of view. And I think that's core thing in policy. People sometimes have this idea that a certain piece of legislation is going to create monopolies, or it's going to be expensive, or it's going to be bad for SMEs. And they have this one idea and they think, I'm going to tell the politicians this idea and they're going to understand. And then you go and talk to the politician, you realize that they don't care at all about the thing that you want to talk about. They want to talk about how this is going to affect music, or how this is going to affect their local industry village they're from. And so I think fiction is an important way to give you insights into the thought processes and the value systems of other people. So those are Liam O'Flaherty and Qi Li are the two authors I'm reading at the moment.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Fiction is indeed wonderful. It is an excellent medium for understanding the world, as are podcasts. And I hope you have enjoyed this one, all of our listeners. If you have enjoyed it, there's a few things you can do. First, like this on Apple, Spotify, your phone, wherever you see it. Two, talk about it. Word of mouth is the best way for this to get out. We do not do a ton of targeted marketing, mostly because we're understaffed and undersupported. So three, support us. Go to opencollective.com/sustainoss and click the donate button. That's right. It's right there beneath this video. It's not a video. This is audible, but you still know what to do. Go donate. It'd be really cool to have more donations to this podcast if you thought it was useful. Besides that, you can go to podcast.sustainoss.org to see the show notes, to see some of our other guests, including, again, as I said, Aster, if you want to learn more about OFE. Kieran, it's been excellent to have you on. I look forward to sharing this publicly. And good luck with everything, especially with lifting up the corner on the Liability Act. It sounds like a heavy lift. But thank you so much. I also know that I think your life changed pretty substantially around a week ago. So I just want to say congratulations, the new kid. I hope everything's going well.
It certainly is. And the new kid arriving in January was perfectly timed with the legislative calendar as well.
Excellent. Well, you look fairly rested. So thank you so much for taking the time. Take care.